morning, happy Thanksgiving, and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. This morning we'll hear about compassion, gratitude, family, and food. Good subjects for Thanksgiving. We'll also take a look at Black Friday, online and in some communities the darkness has already descended. The AARP Fraud Network has some advice you'll want to hear before you get out that credit or debit card. In the second half of the show, we'll hear about a wine and coffee and anything else tasting robot. But before you quit your wine tasting club or fire your sommelier, you'll want to hear the report. But first, we think about compassion and service. November is Family Caregivers Month. With the goal of improving support for family caregivers, Oregonians will soon get more of the tools they need when the Caregiver, Advise, Record, and Enable, or CARE Act, takes effect January 1, 2016. The legislation requires that hospitals adopt written discharge policies to keep family members informed when loved ones need post-hospitalization care. We'll hear comments from John Bartholomew, a government relations director with AARP Oregon. He says the legislation will make family members a part of the care team.
What this should do on several levels is provide better care for the patient, lower stress for the family caregiver, and also reduce hospital readmissions.
The legislation requires hospitals to record a family caregiver's name and notify them when their loved one is discharged, as well as provide written discharge instructions. The caregiver will also be given a demonstration of any medical tasks they need to perform at home, such as wound care or injections.
Whether it's a short-term taking care of somebody after a hospitalization or taking care of a parent or a spouse with Alzheimer's disease, the CARE Act is one piece of that puzzle, and Caregiver Month is all about letting folks know what else is out there for you.
An AARP survey conducted last year found 85% of Oregonians said that they want to live independently at home for as long as possible with the help of family caregivers. For many reasons, a person may find himself at the end of care, in their last days or hours separated from friends or family. A group of special volunteers at Columbia Memorial Hospital are committed to be there so no one needs to pass away alone. Eric Bengel of the Daily Historian shares a look inside this compassionate group.
For 4 years, volunteers with an end-of-life care program at Columbia Memorial Hospital have worked to prevent people from dying alone. As patients await their curtain call, the volunteers sit by their bedside. They read to them and play music. They touch their hand or forearm, monitor their movements, look for signs of pain or discomfort, and alert the hospital staff if anything seems amiss. In short, the volunteers commit to being present with the patients and advocating for their needs, a task they called holding vigil. Inspired by a program at Sacred Heart Medical Center in Eugene, Columbia Memorial's No One Dies Alone program now has 20 volunteers, and since it took off, 45 of the hospital's patients have been spared a lonesome passing, according to volunteer coordinator Laura Lattig. Volunteers usually meet with patients who are actively dying. These are the terminal cases who have stopped eating and drinking and are otherwise physically expiring. Sometimes volunteers step in when a devoted relative just needs a break from the bedside. And if the patient is totally alone, the volunteers pretty much go around the clock with them, unless the patient has already indicated that they would actually prefer to die alone. What is critical, Lattig said, is for volunteers to enter the room with a compassionate heart and to make them feel safe, supported, and loved. Eric Bengel of the Daily Astorian for Coast Community Radio.
Oregon's home baking law goes into effect in less than 2 months, although it will take several more months for the state agriculture department to finalize all the rules. In the meantime, there's plenty for baking entrepreneurs to do to get ready. In addition to perfecting their best recipes, home bakers need to build a customer base and ask their county health department about food safety training. Lauren Gwynn is with OSU's Center for Small Farms and Community Food Systems. She says the law allows baked goods to be sold from home because they don't have the same health risks as other types of fresh foods.
It's really all about the people who are baking these goods following standard best practices around health and hygiene. And those things can be accomplished through the food handler's card requirement that was put into the bill.
Gwynn says the home baking law is part of a growing trend in so-called cottage food laws that help boost and diversify the rural economy. It allows farmers and small producers a way to test market new or small batch products and make a little extra money. The state will have a public hearing on the proposed rules in the spring. Passed last year, the legislation was crafted specifically for small home-based businesses with no plans to become the Internet's next gourmet food sensation. Oregon Food Bank supported the bill for its potential to increase local access to healthier non-processed foods in rural parts of the state. Annalisa Kohler with the Oregon Food Bank describes a few of the basic requirements.
There is a sales limit of $20,000. You will have to sell directly to your customers. You no longer have to have a domestic kitchen license, and you will need to get a food handler's card.
The Oregon Agricultural Department says a draft of the home baking rules should be ready by the end of this year, but won't be finalized until next year. Your Thanksgiving meal this year will probably include some kind of cranberry dish. One out of every five cranberries grown in the United States is eaten Thanksgiving week, according to industry giant Ocean Spray. Here in the Northwest, cranberry farmers hope to convince Americans to eat more berries year-round. Correspondent Chris Lehman has the report.
You probably aren't a real cranberry farmer unless you eat a fair share yourself.
We make them into our own sauce. We use them in salads, cranberry bread. We eat a lot of cranberries.
Scott McKenzie has been harvesting the berries for nearly 20 years on his coastal farm near Port Orford, Oregon. He says most Northwest growers had a fairly average yield this year, a little down from last year, and a robust national harvest kept prices fairly modest. McKenzie says farmers like him sell most of their berries for processing, think juice and canned sauces, but he says more growers are trying to sell their berries in the produce section, where they typically fetch a higher price.
I think that's going to be a bigger part of what we do here in Oregon over the next few years.
Oregon and Washington are among the nation's top five cranberry-producing states, but the region's output is tiny compared to the leaders, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. I'm Chris Lehman reporting.
Just as some people eagerly await the holiday shopping season, it's also a favorite time of year for crooks and cons, and a new survey shows shoppers are giving them plenty of opportunity. The AARP Fraud Watch Network found more than two-thirds of people surveyed failed a basic test for safe shopping at stores and online. More than half said they'll use free, unsecured public Wi-Fi to buy some items. Two-thirds said they'll use a debit card to pay for gifts. Not the best choices for fraud protection, says AARP Washington's Doug Shadle.
If you use a credit card to buy something and some bad guy steals the credit card and imposes a fraud charge, all but $50 is the responsibility of the person issuing the credit card, not your responsibility. Not true with a debit card.
Debit cards are, of course, tied to a person's checking account, making it easy to raid that account if the card and PIN are stolen. A survey of more than 800 people also included questions about buying gift cards. 64% didn't know it's safest to buy them directly from the merchant, not from the racks of cards displayed at other stores. With so much shopping done online, more gifts arrive by mail or delivery service. Shadle says it's important to require a signature for those packages. 83% of those surveyed didn't realize that otherwise the delivery company isn't responsible for it after dropping it off.
We've interviewed identity thieves who will follow the delivery trucks around town and wait for them to deliver the packages and then steal them. I mean, it's a twofer, right? You'll get some personal information about the person you can use to steal their identity, and you also get the box of whatever they had delivered.
Shadle adds research has shown strong correlation between people experiencing stressful negative life events, such as illness or the death of a family member, and being defrauded.
It's just a reminder that going into the holiday season, be especially careful about your buying decisions because you can make mistakes that you wouldn't make otherwise.
In terms of holiday charitable giving, half of those surveyed didn't know that professional fundraisers can legally keep most of the money they raise, as long as they don't lie about it if people ask. This is The Bridge Thanksgiving Morning. We're glad you're listening. If the previous report gave you a bit of a nervous stomach, we have the antidote. Philosopher Seth Titchener was in the studio this week. He recorded some thoughts on the nature of gratitude.
Today is a day for giving thanks, something we're told is pretty important. But why is it important? Why be grateful? And for that matter, what exactly is gratitude? This isn't as obvious as it seems. It's not just something we ought to do. If gratitude was nothing more than a perfunctory obligation, something in which the thought and care toward another wasn't real, it's hard to see how gratitude would, or even could, mean anything. And it's not enough to say that gratitude is something we have because of the fruits or rewards it brings us. If this were the case, gratitude would be a fundamentally selfish act, something where I direct my feelings towards another, so that I might get something later on. If this were the case, in other words, gratitude would be impossible because it would be a fundamentally contradictory act. What's more, there's plenty of things in life that one might eventually come to be grateful for that don't, and really can't, inspire gratitude when they occur. A disappointing love affair that taught important lessons, a failed venture that ultimately opened new doors even as it closed others. These and other things like them are instances of gratitude arising from the very places where it seems like it wouldn't or couldn't. So, what is gratitude, and why do it? Well, let's say what it's not first. And there's one thing that we can be sure it's not. It is not a feeling, or more precisely, it's not merely a feeling, even though it's often accompanied by feelings of gladness, of appreciation, of relief, and a few others. It can't just be a feeling, because if it were, it would vanish with the passing of that feeling, a frivolous event at best. No, in order for the idea of gratitude to look anything like what we call gratitude in our experience, it needs to be cast a little wider. What I mean by this is that gratitude is both a disposition and an act. It's a disposition in that it's a way of being disposed to move those feelings of gladness, of appreciation, of relief, out from the landscapes of memory and present experience, forward into the world that lays before us in time, in space, in community, and even in possibility. And gratitude is an act in that it requires us to find ways to manifest this disposition in our thoughts, our speech, our endeavors, our engagements, and our aspirations, if we are going to bring it into reality. This brings us to why one might be grateful. For one thing, gratitude is an antidote. It's an antidote for a sickness that deludes our psychological and spiritual lives. It is an antidote for resentment, the anger that smolders and corrupts our capacity to appreciate the world as it is, in its many things, as they are, and just so. Resentment is insidious and builds unconsciously. It seeps into and expands the cracks and shadows of our way in the world, and consequently it does so in a manner that leaves us quite unconscious of its progress. In the man of resentment, as Nietzsche says, the soul squints. But gratitude, when cultivated, undoes the seeping corruption of resentment. It puts us in a position to begin quenching the angers and reforming those corruptions that separate us from the world and divide us in ourselves. And here, then, is another reason to be grateful. In moving our feelings of gladness and appreciation forward into the world, particularly when we do so deliberately, we also become more capable of fully taking stock of the worth in where we are and where we've been. We are, in other words, more fully able to live and savor in a wider present and a deeper world, a world where the lyrical and enchanted possibilities of things scintillate even in darker places. With gratitude, we find broader and sharper horizons before us, a world with which we're more at home and a self with which we're more at ease. and all simply because we take the time and effort to stretch our gladness a little further. It is Thanksgiving, so let me leave you with this quote from the classical philosopher Epicurus. "Don't spoil what you have by desiring what you have not. Instead, remember what you have now was something you once only hoped for." A fine recipe for gratitude on this day dedicated to it.
Now we know it's early, but it is a holiday. Take a moment and pour a glass of wine. Sniff it, taste it, think about it. Or just think about it and skip the rest. Food scientists at Washington State University have an unusual new partner to help them evaluate drinks, medicines, and sweeteners. It's called the electronic tongue. Tom Bonsi came face to face with the beastie in Pullman, Washington. It was tasting sparkling wines.
A research team at Washington State University is collaborating with winemaker Chateau Saint Michel to study sugar and carbonation in sparkling wine, specifically how sweet and bubbly to make your bubbly. A traditional way to approach this is to serve sparkling wine with different attributes to a tasting panel.
All right, here's your next sample.
I was among more than 120 volunteer tasters in the study.
I'm asked to rate the aroma and then the taste. Let's take a little sip here. I'm drinking on the job, I'm sorry.
After 4 samples, I have to take a break to rest my palate, and after 7 wines, I'm done. But in a lab 2 doors down the hall, a robot taste tester can analyze up to 20 samples at one sitting.
So this is the electronic tongue.
Professor Carolyn Ross ordered this $90,000 device for her lab in the School of Food Science. PhD student Kenny McMahon uses the e-tongue to rerun the wines we just tasted.
And it doesn't look like a tongue, does it?
The main feature is a robot arm that dips a sensor head into 1-ounce glasses lined up in a carousel.
So it's not responding. Hmm, tasty.
No, it doesn't give human quality aspects or human sounds.
So there's a sensor for sweet, for salty, sour, bitter, umami, which is that kind of meatier, brothy taste. And there's also sensors metallic and for spicy.
Ross bought the electronic tongue from the French instrument maker Alpha Moss.
So we're one of the early academic institutions to purchase one and kind of get in on the ground floor with seeing how it works.
The electronic tongue doesn't gag or tire. The instrument is proving useful to winnow fields of samples and eliminate subjectivity. Its data feeds into research papers and presentations. In this case, the wine industry gets information on how their production tweaks affect the flavor and bubbles and what consumers notice and value.
So at some point, can the machine replace the humans?
No. No, just the complexity of our perception can't be replicated by an instrument.
Some of my fellow human panelists at the wine tasting agree. Alexandria Wyant and Victoria Minette are both food science majors.
I don't think it will totally take over. I think it will help and advance a lot of things that people can't and take out the human error.
There's a lot of what consumers like that the tongue can't give you. So even if the tongue says it has like a perfect taste profile, if the consumers don't have that in their mind as what is ideal, it's not going to be able to tell you what is a good product.
WSU's food scientists found a high degree of correlation between the human panelists and machine results when they previously analyzed sweeteners, apple ciders, red wine, and beer. When people call something bitter, so does the machine. The electronic tongue is finicky, though. Ross says it doesn't like solid food.
It has to be in a liquid form. The sensors are very sensitive, so we have to make sure that there's no fat particles or no big particles, so we have to filter everything.
Manufacturer Alpha Moss says the pharmaceutical and beverage industries are other early adopters of the e-tongue. It helps the pharma industry minimize human or animal taste testing of investigational drugs, where the object is to make bitter medicines more palatable. Meanwhile, coffee and tea producers use it for quality control and to achieve batch-to-batch consistency. I'm Tom Bonsi in Pullman, Washington.
Manufacturer Alpha Moss says the pharmaceutical and beverage industries are other early adopters of the e-tongue. Alpha Moss America General Manager Andrew Cowell said it helps the pharma industry minimize human and animal taste testing of investigational drugs where the object is to make bitter medicines more palatable. Coffee and tea producers use it for quality control and to achieve batch-to-batch consistency. Other buyers of the expensive instrument include soft drink companies to monitor metallic tastes and sweetness, and beer makers to measure bitterness. The electronic tongue has been on the market for more than 3 years. Alpha Moss ships about a dozen to the USA each year. Family and food, two of the hallmarks of Thanksgiving Day. In this country, the afternoon football game is another much-loved tradition in many families. Author Matt Love shares a Thanksgiving memory with us. His family and his memories may remind you of yours.
A Family's Last Thanksgiving Game by Matt Love. 36 years ago on Thanksgiving in Portland, my family played the last of its Thanksgiving football games. No film, video, or photographs exist of the event. It's documented only in my journal I kept for my beginning journalism class. It was a generational affair pitting the male cousins, Matt, Darren, Kurt, versus the uncles, Carl, Dan, Dale, as grandfather watched. It began in the early 1970s as a diversion from the boring halftime show of the Dallas Cowboys game traditionally broadcast on Thanksgiving afternoon. The routine was, watch Detroit lose in the morning, gorge on a feast prepared by the women, watch Dallas play most of the first half, then at the two-minute warning, change clothes, toss the football around, the weather never mattered, play our 45-minute game, come back in, not change our clothes, feast again, and settle into a game that invariably saw Cowboys quarterback Roger Staubach pull it out at the end. As the years passed, the game evolved from a friendly Kennedy family photo op to an intense rivalry. Grandfather kept score as he prowled the sidelines, never cheering, just thinking about pie for dessert, shooting his bad photographs, and proud to see his brood getting dirty on the field. I played quarterback for the Cousins, and we lost every game, usually as a result of a gimmick special teams play or a trick touchdown pass. We came close a few times, and after an especially aching defeat when we lost on a Hail Mary with the score tied, we pledged to go all out in the next game and win in 1979. Something about 1979 made the Cousins ratchet up the seriousness of the game. We talked strategy on the phone in September. I recall at some family gathering, Darren gave Dale, the younger uncle, a tube of Bengay, saying, you're going to need this when the next game is over. Dale didn't think it was very funny. About a week before the 1979 game, the Cousins met, and an incident occurred that made me realize things had changed. In a discussion how to thwart Dale's big play capability, Darren set up a wooden folding chair, coiled into a perfect three-point stance, and announced, this is what I'm going to do to Dale. He then exploded into the chair, sent it flying into a wall 10 feet away, where it shattered into a half dozen pieces. We were in church at the time. It would be almost literature if I could write the game was closed, hinged on a final play. I cannot. We blitzed the uncles from the opening kickoff and won 49-14. We scored on every possession. We seemed faster, more into it. We never let up on the uncles as they had on us in earlier games of the rivalry. When the rout concluded, we all shook hands, and I remember feeling great in a way that I'd never felt before. We headed back inside. I think the woman might have asked, who won? And the two teams gathered up for a second big meal and caught the rest of the finals of the Cowboy game. In 6 months, Grandfather would be dead from a heart attack. Darren, off to college. My dad no longer part of his family's holidays because of a divorce. And I would get my driver's license. We never played football as a family again.
You've been listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. If you missed any part of it or just want to hear it again, it's available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. We're going out this morning with music from Ken Burns' The War, American anthem sung by Nora Jones. On behalf of the board and staff of the Tillicum Foundation, we wish you and yours a very happy day. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge.
America, I gave my to you.